Okay, the car that we're discussing, the Banshee, was a styling exercise, and it was to become a sports car. And myself and Tony Lapine were asked to work on the project in Bill Mitchell's special studio. So we started on the project, and it was to be a front engine, a rear drive. DeLorean had dictated the low pivot rear suspension, which we argued with him about. And there were several things that he definitely wanted in the car. He wanted to use his form of his rope shaft, drive shaft. Mm-hmm. And he wanted the engine placed pretty far forward. And we tried to talk him into sliding the engine back, sliding the passengers back, and getting closer to a 40 front, 60 rear weight distribution, mm-hmm. although it was still a front engine car. Mm-hmm. And he told us we were nuts. And
this is DeLorean, of course.
Right. Yeah. So we finally modeled a car that was more in keeping with what he wanted. And then the program more or less stopped. And we didn't hear any more about it. And then we found out later that they had gone ahead and actually built, that they had taken parts of a Jaguar, and they had actually built a car with a, at this point it was no longer a V8, but they had went to the slant six, or I think the first car was actually a Jaguar, and then they rebodied a E-type Jaguar, and then they put the Pontiac 6 in it. And this car, as I can recall, was a roadster version of the one that Tony Lapine and myself did the design work on. Mm-hmm. And I believe Bill Collins now has the car, or he's he took it over.
Really?
I think he has the actual car.
The actual prototype.
Yeah, the prototype was partially built by Hurst and by Herb Adams, who was sort of the R&D guy at Pontiac.
Mm-hmm. And who still has it?
I believe Bill Collins has the car.
Does he really?
In fact, there was an article in Auto Week back here a couple of years ago, and they showed the car, and they did mention that it was in the hands of Bill Collins.
Oh, really? Now, a recent issue of Auto Week, then?
No, it was about 2 years ago.
Oh, 2 years ago. Okay.
Of course, maybe he might have sold it to get money to build his motorhome.
Mm-hmm. What did Bill Mitchell think of it? Was he pleased with it?
Yeah, I'm not really sure just what his comments were. I think they weren't really too good, mm-hmm. because they went off and did this thing without his sanction.
Oh, I see.
So it's like, mm-hmm. arguing with the Pope. You can only lose. And the name was, the GM loved this name, so they found out a fellow named Bud Goodwin, had a company called FiberFab. He owned the name.
Banshee.
Mm-hmm. So they harassed the guy, and they finally talked him into selling him the name. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he wouldn't put a monetary value on it. He finally said, well, he would let him have the name if they would furnish him two aluminum block Chevrolet engines. And transmissions, uh-huh. and some special equipment. Well, they finally figured out the price of the aluminum engines. I think they gave him one engine and then the money for the other engine, mm-hmm. and he was satisfied. And once they got the name, the legal people found out that Banshee meant a wailing death cry. So that killed the name. No, that was the end of the Banshee.
I presume they wanted their engines back.
No, they never reneged on the deal. Oh, right. He got his engines.
Yeah.
In later years, Bud Goodwin was quite a character. He had a pair of Spanish dueling pistols, and he came home, and his house guest and his wife were having some kind of an affair on the circular staircase of his house, and so he whipped out he ran back to his car, and he got the Spanish dueling pistols, came running in the room and fired the pistols.
Yeah.
And
of
course, well, it was supposed to be, but his wife got hit by a ricochet.
Oh.
And the lead slug had flattened out and it hit her in the temple and killed her.
Oh my God.
And of course, the house guest was a Mexican fellow. Well, he ran out and tripped, I think, fell on the stairs and either broke an arm or a leg, because his pants were down on his ankles.
But, oh, yeah.
And Goodwin ended up with a minor manslaughter charge and ended up serving, I think it was 3 years in jail. But they let him out. They let him out to work during the day, and he had to spend the evenings in jail and weekends.
Where is he now?
Well, he had a heart attack and died about 4, 5, or 6 years ago.
Fascinating. Well, then you're just beginning then at the Pontiac studio about this time, aren't you?
Right.
Uh-huh. And you've come over from Studebaker Packard. Did you tell on our last tape how you went from Studebaker Packard to Pontiac?
Right. Well, I'd met Bunky Knutson, mm-hmm. and Pete Estes at Daytona Beach.
That's right.
Uh-huh. And Knutson suggested that I ought to work for a good company instead of Packard. So, of course I asked him, well, are you offering me a job? And he said, well, no, I can't really hire you at Pontiac, but if you go see Mr. Earl at Harley Earl, well, then he'll probably give you a job. So.
This is in 56, wasn't it?
Right, so then I had a hell of a time getting in to see anybody at GM. And after a lot of harassing, I finally got in and to see a Mr. Jules Andrade, who then called Mr. Earl, and I was then hired after he looked at some of my race car drawings.
Right. Yeah. How do you spell Andrade, by the way?
I believe it was
A-N-D-R-E-A-D-E.
Yeah, I believe so, right.
Andrade, yeah.
Yeah, right.
He was Earl's chief.
He was sort of Earl's right-hand man.
Yeah. Did you like it at Pontiac? Did you get to know Bunky when you were there?
No, actually, then I worked, my first studio was the orientation studio, which mm-hmm. I was there probably about a month and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did a series of drawings, or one drawing in particular of a red car, and it was a Chevrolet, which was very close, similar to the 59 Chevrolet, although the rear of it was closer to the Buick, and the front was more like the Chevrolet. Well, suddenly one morning I came in and the drawing was gone, and they had moved my designer's tabouret and chair down to Chevrolet studio. So I went right to Chevrolet studio, and the drawing was on a easel, and they were working on the model. So
you don't know how it happened.
Well, Mr. Earl or somebody, or might have been in, one of the chiefs had walked through and liked the drawing. So,
mm-hmm. And they moved you down the Chevrolet.
And then the drawing disappeared again, and then I was told that it was at Buick Studio.
Oh, really?
And so went around, and I was in Chevrolet Studio for just about a year.
Yeah.
And of course, Knutson was there, and he'd see me, and he kept saying that I ought to be in Pontiac Studio, so that was the next thing. I moved to Pontiac Studio. And in Pontiac, I worked on the first car I worked, the 59 Pontiac was all set. I worked on the 60 Pontiac and 61 Pontiac. And then the next studio I went to was an advanced studio, actually working on limousines.
Really?
And, well, it was an advanced body development studio, and they were working on limousines. So I wasn't very happy there. So I was drawing limousines with mag wheels and racing gas caps and putting numbers on the roofs. And
that wasn't for you.
Well, finally I almost got fired because I drew a limousine with it had the number on the roof and. Had a little character cartoon of Harlow Curtis riding in the back seat, and
who didn't like that?
Well, it was kind of in bad taste. He had a hunting accident in Canada,
that's right.
And it shot one of the vice presidents with his shotgun, and so I had some ducks painted on the side of the limo, and a vice president also with an X through him.
Oh no!
So, and it was just a little cartoon, but somebody saw it. And,
didn't care for
that. No, they didn't like that. So,
let's go back a bit. You were You were the design assistant to the group chief designer at the Chevrolet Studios. Who was that?
That was Irv Verbicki.
He was?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. What about your relationship with him? How did it work?
I was always a very good relationship. Mm-hmm. Irv was probably one of the, probably helped my career probably more than anybody else, other than Bill Mitchell. Uh-huh. He told me I was pushing to become an assistant chief designer and move up the ladder.
Right.
And he said, Larry, he says, the last thing you want to do is become an assistant chief designer. He says, because quite often it's a dead-end street.
Oh, is that true?
If you'll look around, you'll notice that there's a lot of assistant chiefs that have been assistant chiefs for 10, 12 years. And,
Says,
yeah, that is true. So he says, I think you have higher goals in your own mind, right?
That's
right. And I said, yes, I do. And he said, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to make you my design assistant, I'll call you.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the first chief job opens, you'll have it.
Uh-huh.
And that's what happened. So
he did find you one in the Studio 3, apparently.
Right, that was an advanced studio and was set up in the warehouse.
In the warehouse?
Right.
On
12 Mile Road.
12 Mile Road, yeah. Well, what kind of advance must have been fun in Chevy in those days? Chevy was the big car line and they were doing lots of interesting things.
Well, the advanced studio that I was in was just strictly high-performance cars and Corvettes.
Was it?
So that was even more fun than, just a normal, regular advanced studio.
Was this about your first move into that area, which has been one of your chief areas over the years?
Right. Well, no. Prior to that, when I went from the limousine studio, I went right into Mitchell's special studio.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And at that point in time, in fact, when I was in the special studio, I was doing work on, for Bill Mitchell on the site,
right,
on the Stingray.
Mm-hmm. So what did you do in Studio 3? Do you remember any highlights there?
Yeah, well, we did in Studio 3, when I became a chief designer, one of the first cars we did was the theme model for the 68 Corvette.
Uh-huh.
And we did the Mako Shark.
And the one that Bill Mitchell liked so well?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, there were actually two Mako Sharks.
Yeah.
The first one was a modified 61 Corvette.
Mm-hmm.
And it had it had first been done, and it was called, the first car was called the XP700.
Uh-huh.
And Bill Mitchell did that one all by himself. No credit for that one.
Really?
Yeah, that's a car with about four different chins under the mouth. And it had a double bubble roof. And Bill wanted to change that and make it look like it was the evolution for the 63 Corvette. And actually, the 63 Corvette was all done when the Mako Shark 1 was done.
Was it really?
Yeah, it was. So then we did the car, and then of course it was shown around as the predecessor to the Stingray, which was not really the case.
Yeah, this caption that I'm reading here, the famous Mako Shark in its original form was created by William L. Mitchell as vice president of the GM design. It served as one of the prototypes for the Stingray. It was named after its styling, but not so.
No, it was really not so.
How did the evolution come about?
The evolution was that the Stingray race car was done first.
Mm-hmm.
And the car was raced, and then the production car was started. And at one point in time, it was called a Q car.
The Q car?
It was called, there was a car called the Q car, which was a little similar. But it had the very high nose. It was designed to be a inverted airfoil that was supposed to give a downforce, which in this case never proved out. In fact, the 63 Corvette in production form probably had the highest amount of lift than any car devised in modern days.
This book called Dream Cars by Michael Frostick also mentioned.
It's a smaller version of the book, isn't it?
The Mark II, yeah. Oh, is this a larger version?
Oh, no, I've never seen this book.
The Mark II he mentions at the bottom of the page there.
Yeah, the Mark II was the, well, here's the XP700.
Okay, fine, yeah. So.
That was the start of the XP700 was the,
right.
That became the Mako Shark 1.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Mako Shark 2 was the was a modified 65 Corvette.
Mm-hmm.
And that got the whole new body that was to be the predecessor to the 68 Corvette.
Yeah.
And basically, a lot of the 68 Corvette was in that car.
The caption.
And of course, there was another car that they're probably not showing in there. It was called the XP819, and it was a rear engine. The engine overhung the rear axle like the Corvair, and the body shapes and everything were very close to the. Were all very close to what the 68 Corvette production car was.
Oh, really?
Had the same roof roof schematic. Basically, same fender shapes, and it had the narrow pinched-in waist that was on the 68 Corvette.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that car was done as a just as a design and engineering exercise for Frank Winchell with Chevrolet R&D.
Mm-hmm.
Frank and Bill Mitchell were they were really opposed to one another because they. Yeah, Mitchell had a lot of flair, and Mitchell always figured Frank was kind of a klutz, and vice versa. So, and you know, I had to work between both of them and keep both happy. So,
yeah. You need all your diplomacy.
And I'm not known for that. So.
It mentions here that there was a fuel injection in the XP 700.
Yes, there was.
Yeah, probably one of the fairly earliest.
Well, the fuel injection, it was a regular Corvette fuel injection, and then at a later date, they had a Latham supercharger that was also, first had carburetors, and then it had an injection system on it.
Uh-huh. What's your recollection of the guy who supposedly engineered the Corvette?
Duntoff?
Yeah, Duntoff. What's his name
there? It's Zora Arkus Duntoff.
Yeah, right.
And there was an article, a very, very good article that was written. I can't remember the guy's name, but he writes for the Sports Illustrated.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a marvelous article that I guess is very factual on Zora Duntoff.
That appear in Sports Illustrated?
Yes. If you were to check back, I'm not sure just how many years ago it was, but it was a very concise, very thorough article.
Very well done.
And it also completely explained the hyphenated name.
Mm-hmm.
Because Zora's mother, I guess, was quite a lady, and she had two husbands. One with a daytime husband and a nighttime husband. And it was almost like some movie where,
Guinness.
Captain's Paradise.
Captain's Paradise, yeah, right. Yeah. The working with Rybicki was fun, but you moved on to a special vehicle
group after that, right? Yeah. Yeah, and that was all through the Chevrolet time, it was basically I reported to Irv Rybicki, and it was it was very satisfying because he's a very fair person.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhat cautious, but fair,
mm-hmm.
And he would be a mediator. He would take one studio and pit it against another studio, and quite often the case would be this Henry Haga studio.
Yeah.
And whenever we'd have a real design contest, he'd always lose, and he'd always cry. He was a real crybaby, so. And Irv would always say, Jesus Christ, Larry, don't rub it in so hard when you win.
Here's the Banshee.
Yep, that's not quite that. This was a show car. Then they did a production car that was
even better.
Yeah, well, the production car was based on that car, on that design, but. I remember Mitchell was never really too keen on that. In fact, I'll have to see if I can get that book. I've never seen that one.
Yes, you can take a look at it after we finish. Yeah, it's good. Well, you were doing limousines and you were doing scut work in the specialist vehicles, and you really didn't care for it.
Well, the special vehicles, what it was they had me coordinating efforts between the different staffs. I was taking care of all the GM show cars, the Chevrolet show cars in particular.
Right.
And then they had me working with the different R&D groups.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, it was just two. It was Pontiac and Chevrolet, and with engineering staff.
That's all they had, just two?
Well, Oldsmobile R&D, Buick,
mm-hmm.
and Cadillac, and then I was doing some work with Phil Ziegler, who was at Saginaw Steering. Ziegler, Z-E-I-G-L-E-R.
Mm-hmm.
Then he later went as vice president of Harrison, and I'm not sure where he at. He's probably retired now.
But mm-hmm.
He was a real energetic, engineer with just a hell of a lot of hell of a lot of ideas. Some of them bad,
mm-hmm.
more good than bad, I think. But
so balanced out.
So we ended up doing a car for Smokey Unick. For Smokey Unick.
Who's that?
He's the guy from at Daytona Beach that has. Well, he's doing a vapor cycle engine. He's done a lot of things, and he's really a character.
Can you spell his last name?
Y-U-N-I-C-K.
Okay.
And, some people would call him Smokey Unique, spelt the other way, but he's a real unique person. And this car had a special suspension that was going to lean, and so it'd camber into the corners.
Uh-huh.
And the racers all ended up calling it the Python, because they were saying, well, it was a python that ate the pig, because it had kind of a bulging body side on it. And the engine sat in the car at a kind of a slight off. It was actually angled into the car.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't, the engine center line didn't follow the center line of the car. And first Jim Rathman was supposed to drive the car, and he scared him so bad that he got out. They finally put Curtis Turner in the car, the stock car driver, and he made some pretty fair comments on the car. He says, I don't know what I look like out there, but he says, I would imagine I look like a monkey screwing a football. and finally, I think he crashed the car.
He did.
And that was the end of it. It just didn't work. But
it was an interesting time for you.
Right.
Lots of new projects.
Right.
But you decided to move on after what?
Well, what happened was, after a while of doing this research work with the different groups,
yeah.
The engineering staff, and at that point in time, and Frank Winchell had moved from Chevrolet to engineering staff.
Oh, yeah.
And, I finally had kind of decided, I was going to take a job where I've been negotiating with Toyota for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
Talking them into opening a U.S. design operation to input U.S. thinking back into the Japanese product.
Mm-hmm.
And came fairly close to having this happen, and I went and I talked to Bunky Knutson, who is now had been passed over for the presidency, and he was executive vice president for overseas operations.
Mm-hmm.
Similar kind of a position that Bob Stemple has now.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And he told me he said, you don't want to go to work for those people. He says, why don't you hang around a little bit? He says, I've got something planned, he says, and you'll be part of it, so. I hung on for a bit, and then at Daytona Beach that year, Harley Earl made a kind of a casual statement. He says, Larry, you've been doing a good job. He says, some exciting things are going to happen here shortly. He says, I'm sure you'll be part of it, and then you'll go along and help Bunky.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I,
that was it.
I says, yeah, that's quite likely what'll happen. And sure enough, well, and then the Ford announcement came out.
You had no inkling of that?
No, I thought, I wasn't sure.
Uh-huh.
But then, so right off the bat, the plan was 2 weeks later, I'm supposed to go to work at Ford.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't happen. So there was a lot of negativism, I guess, on board Nay's part to hire me. So when I finally went over to Ford, I went there about 3 grade levels lower than I was supposed to go. So instead of going over as a 18, I went over as a 15, and they gave me the title of design exec.
Which is pretty good, wasn't it?
Well, it was pretty good, but at that point in time, I should have gone in as a director.
Yeah, right.
And it took me 7 months of concerted hard work and stepping on a lot of toes, but I've pretty much forced the issue, and they
made you a director.
Made me a director.
Oh.
Well, I was a director of special projects design office.
Mm-hmm. Let's hold it for a second. We're moving ahead a bit at Ford in chronology, but something which you've been talking about, if you could set the scene for us in this particular episode.
Well, this was regarding they're calling the car, the code name was a Phoenix, and this was for the Pinto.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a model that Mr. Ford had approved, and it was dynocked and was painted gold. And they had a design meeting where they had the Phoenix model or Pinto on one turntable in the auditorium, and they had a Volkswagen Beetle,
mm-hmm.
all dynocked and or painted gold with the windows blacked out, and you know, they were very proud of themselves. They had this car that looked better than a Beetle.
Can you describe what the Phoenix looked like?
The Phoenix was very reminiscent to what the Mustang II, the terrible mistake Mustang II
mm-hmm.
was.
Right.
It was a notch back, and it was the wheels were too small, and it had exaggerated wheel, real heavy wheel lips,
mm-hmm.
and the grill and the taillights, everything had the motif of a chicken wire or honeycomb,
mm-hmm.
kind of
a
squashed honeycomb shape,
yeah.
and even the bumper had kind of a honeycomb look to it,
mm-hmm.
in the plan form,
mm-hmm.
and it was just, you know, it was utter terrible looking car.
Mm-hmm.
So they asked everybody around the room what they thought of it, and most people didn't really comment one way or the other. And when they got to me, I told them what I thought, and I think everybody was kind of shocked. And so then I told them I'd like to show them a different model. So they said, well, they didn't want to see a cardboard mock-up or some drawings. They wanted to see a clay model.
Was this Muggy Knudsen that said that?
Right. That's what Knudsen said. So I said, well, that's what I want to show you. He said, well, when? I says, when do you want to see it? You want to see it dynocked in these same colors? And he said, yes, of course. So I said, okay, at 1 o'clock we'll have it.
What was this, in the morning?
This was at 7 in the morning.
Yeah.
And
one of Knudsen's favorite times.
Yeah, so they all agreed. Bordenay said, the only words he said to me were, what the hell are you going to show him? I says, I'm going to show him the model I've been asking you to look at for 2 weeks, and you've been too busy to come and look at it. He saw that. He says, well, come on, Don, let's go have breakfast.
Don Peterson?
No, De La Rosa.
Oh, Don De La Rosa, yeah. They were great buddies, weren't they?
So they went to the Dearborn Inn for breakfast.
Yeah.
And we got real busy. We changed the dynoc color, got the model all ready.
Who was working with you then?
In the studio?
Yeah.
Well, the chief modeler was a fellow named Benny Barbera.
Yeah, he's still there.
Yep.
Mm-hmm, right.
And there's a younger modeler, a fellow named Bill Neamy. There, I forget all the people. But
was Bill Wheeler with you? Or Wheeler with you then?
Dave Wheeler.
Or Dave Wheeler, I mean.
No, Dave Wheeler. He worked in a different area, and he. And of course, and you know, after he heard me mention this, then he put his 2 cents in that he'd like to do another model. He'd like to do a model.
Dave did.
He'd like to do a model, and he did a model. Then there was a big scramble. But prior to that, come 1 o'clock, everybody's there, including Iacocca, and there's no De La Rosa, no Bordenay, so. Knutson says, Larry, call Bordenay's office and find out where the hell he's at. So I call him, I say, can't be bothered, he's in conference. He grabbed one phone, Iacocca grabbed the other phone, and they chewed out Bordenay's secretary. And the next thing I knew, we saw the limo go tearing by the window, heading for the Dearborn Inn. And about 10 minutes later, it comes back, and Bordenay climbs out all dapper and walking with his head down, because he was probably, you know, he's probably been drinking Chivas Regal since early morning. Right. And De La Rosa comes out like a complete clown. He can't walk straight, and he's almost fallen down. And they walk in, and they sit down in the auditorium, and their seats are just for the president and the vice presidents.
The rest of the people stand.
Everybody else stands. So De La Rosa was standing, and he went over and leaned against the wall. And while the presentation's going on, he slid right down the wall on his back. So when the lights came on, they were all quite impressed, and not totally pleased, but quite impressed that the car that I showed was had a lot of promise.
Can you describe it?
Well, it was. Well, the car was a fastback instead of a notchback, and the front was much less pronounced. It still had some of the honeycomb quality, but squashed way down. In fact, quite close to what the actual Pinto came out with, and it had gone to a very simple bumper blank. So the bumper blank front and rear were the same, and the car did have a very long. Long doors for easy entrance to the back seat, but the overall shape was very much like how the Pinto Fastback did come out. So,
what year was this again?
This was in '69.
'69, right?
And early '69, and so then they started a big design program, and then of course I was pulled out of the program. I didn't participate in the final, other than more or less as a as an observer.
Yeah.
And they went through about 25 clay models coming up to the final design. And the final design had a lot of the same qualities as the model that I did. We'd taken in the body side and made the wheel lips smaller. And just the overall look of the car was quite clean.
But you never really got credit for it.
No, I never got credit for it. The only person that I ever heard that gave me credit was Don Peterson. When somebody had asked him that, you know, how had this all transpired, and he'd mentioned that this meeting had happened and what basically had happened, and that the model I did had quite a bit of influence on the final outcome of the car.
Peterson was at the meeting you just described.
Yes, he was at the meeting.
Yeah.
And. After the meeting, the lights came on. Knutson looked over and says, saw De La Rosa laying prone on his back and says, what's wrong with him? I said, well, sir, he's drunk. He said, no, you gotta be kidding. So he walked over and he looked down at De La Rosa and he's laying there with a big grin on his face and he said, how's your ass, Bunky?
What did Knutson do?
Just turned and walked away.
Yeah, nothing you could do with De La Rosa.
And even Iacocca was you could see there was a complete look of disgust. And, you know, Bordenay was feeling no pain, so.
Sitting down in one of the sacred chairs. Well, I'd like to hear more about that. I want to go back in time very briefly to an era that's really impressed me. Those magnificent things you did for Bill Mitchell, those incredible concept cars that you did. What is your favorite out of all?
My favorite is Monza GT.
Tell us a bit about that.
That car was done.
This one
right
here, yeah.
The car was actually done as a joint project between Chevrolet Research and Development, Frank Winchell, and the design staff people. Tony Lapine was working in the studio with me. We had done a car that was taller. It was 44 inches tall.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a mid-engine car. And Chevrolet R&D had done a whole series of Corvair-powered cars that were front-wheel drive.
Mm-hmm.
And they had been talking about doing a front-drive car. And I guess Ford was looking at doing a car called the Cardinal, and this was going to be the GM's answer to the Cardinal.
Uh-huh.
And it finally just kind of went away, and they decided to take the technology that Chevy R&D had and bring it together with the design talents of the design staff people and build a car.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a case in point. There was Bob McLean, who ran the research department, had worked on a car that could never see fruition because it was all too exotic. But the only thing that we did steal from it was a big, basic height.
Mm-hmm.
His car was about 41 inches tall, and or it was 40 inches tall, and we actually ended up building a car that was 41 inches tall.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the Monza GT was.
Mm-hmm.
And we took this car that was a little pudgier and actually squashed it down, and as Mitchell would say, put the creases in the pants and some interest, and it's a car that it's probably a car that I basically laid every line on the car.
Really?
I think it's, I feel very proud of it because it's today it still looks fairly modern. They drug it out and cleaned it up and showed it at their 75th anniversary.
Did they?
That was a theme car in the middle of the courtyard. So
they still have it, huh?
Oh, yes. They keep all their show cars.
Yeah.
And it's still in good running condition.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. There were some other well-publicized ones. You've talked about the Mako Shark. Was there the Manatee? Was that part of
No.
No, there wasn't. But Bill seemed to like to have you do these special cars for him.
Well, there was a Corvair Spider. There was a Super Spider. There was a Corvair Spider, which was a Corvair shortened up 15 inches and made into a two-passenger little sports car.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a Super Spider, which was the same motif with a new front and a new rear, which the front had kind of wishbone shapes around the headlights, and
those are nice. That Super Spider I see here got a design excellence award.
Yeah, from
Automobile Quarterly.
Right.
Yeah, that's a gorgeous car. Is that still around?
As far as I know, it's still around. Yes.
Uh-huh. The Mitchell seemed to have a thing for these exotic sports cars. Did he have you sort of a one man? Advanced studio for him?
Right. In fact, there was one car that's not in this book, and it's the only published pictures I've seen of the car is in another book. It's called Dream Cars, and it's the larger format book.
We have it,
yeah. Yep, that's it there.
Okay. What's it called?
It's called the X15.
Ah, okay.
And that car was started out life as the Scarab Formula One car.
Uh-huh.
Front engine, rear drive, and it was, to my knowledge, was only raced as a Formula Libra car.
Really?
And Bill Mitchell wanted that car. He had this dream that he wanted this Formula One car that he could drive on the street.
Uh-huh.
And so he traded two Corvettes for that car.
Really?
From Lance Reventlow.
Really?
Yeah. So. There were two 65 Corvettes, fuel injection coupes.
Mm-hmm.
They're really nice cars, and he swapped the two Corvettes for the Scarab, and then he had me restyle it to his likes.
Mm-hmm.
The pictures in the book, the car was initially done. It was black. And then he wanted a metallic black, so it came out a very dark gunmetal silver.
Uh-huh.
And then I see it now, it's been, was painted scarab blue, the pictures in the book are, and it's got some,
yeah.
It's got some pretty terrible stripes put on, which I didn't do. But the car, well, it was kind of one of those fun projects where you do a lot of things, and
yeah.
The more you do, the more you liked. And it finally to a point that it was getting really almost like a cartoon. Have you seen the pictures in there?
Yeah, that's good. Now, this is the one you're talking about,
yes.
The Libra X15, huh?
Right. Well, it does mention it's a Reventlow formula Libra, but the car started out life as it had much shorter front overhang.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a plaster cast of the original body.
Uh-huh.
And then they removed all the body panels and brought this plaster cast over and set it up in the studio, and then we started modeling on it. And of course, we also had to lengthen the car. I think it was lengthened 5 inches, so it would accept a reverse gear in the transmission.
Mm-hmm.
And just all the body surfaces were recovered. And then there were actually the rear wheel pants were made up. That they rode on the rear suspension. I noticed in the one picture they're not shown in the front view, but
right.
You see them in the side view. They
right. They
rode along with the suspension. The front fenders, there were no front fenders, they were just kind of dive planes that stuck out that would take the splash off the tires.
Uh-huh, right.
And, it had a heater, and it had actually no air conditioner, but it had a heater.
Uh-huh.
And Bill Mitchell was going to drive this, and in fact, even had a hidden license plate that would drop out, remote control would
really?
Pop out and back and would retract. And, Bill Mitchell was going to drive it on the street, and if anybody stopped and or wanted to race him, he'd hand him a business card that was going to say something rather derogatory on it.
Uh-huh.
So I just told him, I said, well, you better not run across Frank Winchell, because he's liable to jump out and grab your car and turn it upside down on you. Which, you know, Mitchell didn't think that was very funny.
Yeah, right.
But the car was, he used to drive it on weekends at around the tech center.
Mm-hmm.
And finally got up enough nerve, he drove it home.
Mm-hmm.
And it was parked in his driveway, and Jack Gordon, who was the president of the company, lived mm-hmm. not too far from Mitchell.
Uh-huh.
So one Sunday, he came driving in his Cadillac, came driving in Mitchell's driveway, and almost ran over this black snake parked in his driveway. So he asked, what the hell is that?
Uh-huh.
Mitchell couldn't explain it.
He couldn't.
So the next Monday, Panic City.
Why couldn't he explain it?
Well, there wasn't any way he could explain it. How could you explain the monies that it took to do that.
Okay. That's what Gordon wanted to know.
Oh, yeah.
Where'd you get the authorization and the money
right.
to do this? Yeah, okay.
So they hit it out. He said, well, it belongs to a friend.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, it's.
Yeah.
Here's the helmet's painted in black and it says, you know, Bill on the side of it. And
did Gordon institute an investigation?
No, not right at that point. I think later there was.
There was, huh?
So, all I know is that the car is still painted blue and a rather decrepit. All the original body panels are back on it, and it is now back in the Briggs Cunningham Museum in Costa Mesa.
Yeah, in Costa Mesa, Arizona?
No, California.
California, yeah. And it's still there, probably.
Right.
Yeah, oh, that's fascinating.
In fact, they're refurbishing it for a historical event.
Are they? Oh, my gosh.
And somebody was asking me, though, one of the builders, well, Dick Troutman.
Mm-hmm.
Was asking me, saying, Larry, we got the body bucks out. We can't understand it.
The body what?
Well, they were making some new body panels.
Okay.
We can't understand. The cowl pieces don't fit. I said, yeah, they're 5 inches too short.
Mm-hmm.
He says, yeah. He says, how'd you know?
No kidding.
So, you know, and then he finally had to point out the reverse gear in the transmission. He says, oh, Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm. Is this somebody doing it for Briggs Cunningham?
Yes.
Yeah. Troutman is a familiar name. He's been
yeah, Troutman and Barnes, they built the original car.
That's it. Okay, they're a prototype builders. Huh?
Yes, and they built the original Scarab also. Which,
did they? Uh-huh.
And,
When the Bill switched with them.
No. This was the Scarab sports car.
Oh, the Scarab sports car. Okay, not the
right.
racing car. Yeah.
Yeah, which was a very famous sports car.
Mm-hmm.
And they've also built a second replica for... I believe it's Lance Ravello's brother.
Uh-huh.
And,
where's the scarab now?
They're both at, well, they're, this car's in, at the Briggs Cunningham Museum, and
right.
the original scarab is also there.
Hmm. Costa Mesa, I've got to get up there.
Yeah, it's a nice museum. He has some very nice, nice cars.
Hmm. Let's explore a bit your actually coming to Ford. You were happy at General Motors, but wanted you to come along and give him
right.
a hand, though.
Well, I wasn't real happy the last...
That's right, you're beginning to sour.
Well, 6 or 7 months, they had me work, they as this coordinator for all these different areas, I was no longer reporting to Rubicki, which was unfortunate. I reported to an engineer that I didn't think to, you know, he was a nice guy, but he was, you know, he wasn't a very good engineer, and he was not a very good manager, so. And you can never understand how I knew so many people and how I could get things done with, you know.
Yeah.
He could really not understand how I could do what I could do without without a doctorate or, out, you know, some degree, and he was a doctor. He had a doctorate from Ball State University.
In engineering.
Yeah, in engineering.
Yeah.
So you know, that was kind of a sour thing. So.
You think that Knudsen actually asked for you to come along with him?
Oh, he did.
Because
oh, no.
you mentioned that that Harley Earl said you're going to go and help Bunsen.
Right. Well, that was. Yeah, he knew that. Well, he'd asked me to not go to Toyota, and that he had plans. And then when it did happen, he asked me what.
Yeah.
Well, it took so long for me to go get there. Now, in the meantime,
he went on ahead.
Yeah, so Knudsen went right over there and went to work. I believe it was March 1st.
Mm-hmm.
See, the Daytona race was the end of February.
Right.
And.
This is in 60.
Right, so that's where Iacocca's book's all wet. Iacocca claims that Knudsen started at Ford in, the day after Thanksgiving.
In 69?
No, 68.
I'm 68, but
he was there in March.
You were really there in March?
Yeah, so, you know, yeah. you know, people shouldn't write books and they're incorrect.
Well, this of course immediately set Iacocca's nose out of joint. He was an adversary from the very beginning. Wasn't
right.
He tried to block your.
I don't think he had anything to do with. I'm sure he had nothing to do with trying to blocking my coming to.
No.
That was all Bourdonnais.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So you installed then eventually. When? How long did it take you to go?
Well, it was May of '69, or May of '68. So I went from March, April, and then May.
Were you working for GM at the time, or were you?
Right.
Liberty?
No, it was in fact, I never told GM until, day I was going to leave.
Yeah. So, what was the situation in the design center when you got there?
Everything was pretty chaotic, but,
was
but in the meantime, Dave Wheeler had gone over from GM and got a job.
Independent of your?
Independent of my deal, and he ended up with a...
Somebody thought that he came with you, but
no,
that,
no, he was there earlier. He was there earlier, and actually, and the first thing he did was he alienated himself with Iacocca.
How did you do that?
Well, by kissing his ass.
Oh, I see, yeah. And,
he did a bunch of programs, you know, they were all for Lee, and, you know, and he actually almost kind of became a turncoat right going in.
Really? Uh-huh, yeah. But Knudsen and... you reported pretty much to Henry Ford II.
Well, no. I reported to Bourdonnais.
I know, but I mean hierarchically, but Knudsen was really a Henry Ford II man. And he didn't have to bother about Iacocca at this point.
Right. Well, that was pretty much the case. But then it was, you know, he didn't bring enough troops.
Yeah.
And when he had the big hammer, he didn't use it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I kept telling him that, you know, one of the first things he asked me to do was to look through the company and
right.
you know and report back to him. And when I reported back to him, he didn't like my report.
Well, he didn't. What did you recommend?
I recommended using the big hammer and actually
getting rid of a lot of dead wood.
Yeah, so you got to get rid of a lot of dead wood, and you got to get rid of your main adversaries right now. Mm-hmm. Right, you got to nip it at the bud, or it's gonna grow and eat us up.
Who would that have been?
That would have been Iacocca and his cronies.
Yeah, who were they?
Oh, they were so widespread it would have probably been difficult to get them all out.
An army.
Yeah, he had an army.
Was Eugene Bournet an Iacocca partisan?
I don't really think so.
You don't think so?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
It's hard to say. I've heard some pretty derogatory things coming from Bournet about Iacocca, and I've heard some things coming the other way also. So it's I don't think there was really a whole lot of love lost.
I suspect that Bournet was the consummate politician. He would be able to swing with the wind, wind. And if he thought it was advantageous for him to be an Iacocca partisan, he would.
Yeah.
How did Knudsen and Bournet get along?
Well, I don't think they got along too well because, Knudsen had definite ideas on styling and, and he used to always, he was very vocal about it. I can't fully agree with him on some of the things that he did do.
Yeah.
Like the Thunderbird nose and things I never much cared for. Yeah. So
what was your first assignment at Fort when you got there?
Well, first assignment was, first assignment was basically to take over some projects that were being done in a basement studio.
You got a title director after a while, director of special projects.
Right, but first I was a design exec.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I had show cars, show vehicles, there was a fellow named John Najar that we were kind of we kind of shared the same office, in fact.
Yeah.
And we had offices right next to each other. And he more or less was given the industrial design part of the business, and I was given the passenger car part of following up on the show cars.
Right.
Uh-huh. And I did a good job, and got a lot done, got a lot accomplished, turned a few things around. Mm-hmm. And so then the next thing was to have this directorship, and then, they widened my responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
So it covered all of the industrial design, plus the shows and displays, special vehicles, and then all high-performance vehicles.
Oh, really?
You know, all fell into my...
That's a pretty broad portfolio.
Right, it was. So,
yeah. What were some of your triumphs in that area that you consider?
Going in early, putting together the Boss 302 Mustang,
Now this come about with this is kind of an important period. Everybody's in this era. Was this pretty much a combined project? Yours and Newt's, and you and he got together and decided what.
Right. Well, we knew what had to happen, and to try and capture some of the youth market.
Right.
Saying, well, you had to have cars that would run, street machines that would run like your race cars.
And sure.
Ford had never had that before, so the idea was to get. Quite obviously, Knudsen wanted to beat the Z28s, beat the Chevrolets at their own game. So that was actually my first task coming in there. The show cars plus getting that program going.
Uh-huh.
And by hook or crook, I probably pissed off a lot of people, but that goes without saying. But I knew what kind of horsepower the Z28 had, and where its strong points and weak points were, so I had to find out quickly what the Mustang was all about and what the new developments were. And what they were working on was pretty much wrong. They were working on an engine with high horsepower, but with enormous ports, and the horsepower was very, very peaky. So they needed something with a much flatter torque curve, and they needed a car that had better, vehicle dynamics. So and they were saying, well, all it has to do is go fast. We don't worry about whether it stops or you know, if it goes fast, well, then it's got good brakes, well, you'll get through the corners. I told him, well, that's not really where it's at.
Yeah.
The Z28 gets through the corners because it handles well. So it goes through the corner well and accelerates coming off the corner because it's got through the corner fast.
Mm-hmm.
And so automatically you think it's got more horsepower, and it really doesn't, but it's going through the corner faster.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him, and the reason it's going through the corner faster, it has better aerodynamics. It has enough downforce in the front, balanced with downforce in the rear, so that it's pretty well balanced.
Mm-hmm.
Your car has some downforce on the rear that's built in with the little built-in spoiler, but none on the front. And suspension isn't quite right. They said, well, what do you know about it? You're a designer. I said, well, I'm a designer, but I've got common sense, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I know a little bit about vehicle dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
And Ford at that point never used their skid pad to check out the vehicle dynamics of the cars.
Really?
And their skid pad was in real sorry shape because here at Dearborn it was all tore up.
Where's that located?
Right out here in the Dearborn test track, right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So first thing, I got an appropriation, they repaved it.
Good.
And took the people in the company plane, we flew over the GM proving grounds. You see that thing out there?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, well, we say, what is it? I said, it's Black Lake.
Oh.
Well, what's it for? I said, well, we'll fly around, you can see. Well, sure enough, they were running. Sure enough, here's Roger Penske's Camaro out there.
Yeah.
The Sunoco Camaro, and it's running on the skid pad. And so finally that they had the long lenses on the camera, and they took pictures, and I said, see, you know, that's what you need.
What type of surface would you have for a skid pad?
Well, it just has to be a fairly smooth, consistent asphalt with a either 120-foot radius circle, and then one maybe at 190.
Mm-hmm.
At 90-foot.
Mm-hmm.
And you can run on either one of them, and basically check out your lateral acceleration. And you can play with aerodynamics, you can play with suspension.
Oh, really?
Roll stiffness, what have you, and you
uh-huh.
can, you know, and also with tires, and you can find out what's going to get around there the fastest, and that, and of course you'll have to do some adjustments to a racetrack, but then it's there. Once you establish it, you know, and you can run it in both directions at, you know, fairly normal, then, you know, you've got it pretty well dialed in. So they
did. They agree to that.
They finally did. It took a hell of a lot of beating them on the head.
Oh, really? they just couldn't see that it would be beneficial.
No, most of the people in the performance department didn't understand vehicle dynamics, which was really kind of, and it's not that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the people at Chevrolet and basically Frank Winchell kind of wrote the book on that part of it. They knew more about tires than Goodyear. You know, and they found it all out themselves. Winchell was the kind of a guy that was inquisitive, and he'd say, well, find out, tell me why the goddamn hell it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And don't come back until you can tell me. And his engineers would, they'd go out and scrape, and they'd come back and say, well, this is why, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He even built a machine that to check tires. Had a Corvair engine out on the end of a beam, and was on a small skid pad. And you could, the operator sat at the center point, and he'd go around on this thing with this Corvair engine running out on the out on the end, and you could change the gear ratio. You could also plug in, tow out, change the camber angles,
mm-hmm.
and run this tire so you could find out, and the tire was all instrumented.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd shave tires to get it down to, a lot of it was done for the Corvair, litigation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So
and then perfect on that.
Yeah. So then it went from that. It went into tire development,
uh-huh.
tire dynamics, and they ended up knowing a lot more than Firestone and quite a bit more than Goodyear.
The tire engineers would come up to
Chevrolet
and say what's going on.
Yeah, and it's.
Because Frank Winchell, he seemed like a legendary character.
No, he is.
Is he still around?
Oh yeah.
Where is he located?
He's out in Orchard Lake.
Retired.
Retired, and then he has a house in Juneau Beach, just north of Palm Beach.
Uh-huh. Does he come back in the spring?
Yeah.
I'd Wouldn't it be interesting to talk to him?
I think it would be.
About his career?
Yeah, I think he'd really be a interesting guy to talk to, because he...
Fascinating, yeah. I'd like to get into body engineering with some people.
Well, in his case, well, it's not body engineering. This is all research and development.
Research and development. But I think that's an area which should be covered, too.
Yeah, because his stories are, you know, he can tell you war stories, he just won't quit.
Oh, that's marvelous. Do you see him, though?
Not that often, but...
Well, perhaps if you see him before I do, you could mention our project. So you're installed as pretty much, are you known as, forgive me if I presume here, are you known as Bunky's Boy at this point?
Yes, pretty much so.
And that gives you a certain stigma with some people that...
Right.
That sort of hampers your ability to move.
Right, well, then it's the other case in point. That's part of it. And then the other thing is, well, I think I overcame a lot of that with a lot of the people that they were saying, well, performance is that's the name of the game,
sure,
and winning is what we want to do. Right. We don't want to lose. So, yeah.
The 302 is a legendary vehicle. Can you tell us a little bit about how that came about?
Well, the car was, well, they had been working on a car. I forget all the engineers' names, but they were working on the car, and then there was also a product improvement program,
uh-huh.
and I think I would have won the product improvement program because I removed things off the car and without hurting the looks of it or the performance.
Yeah.
And
what had they come up with? What kind of a vehicle?
They'd been working basically, with some wider tires, a little bit of suspension things, but they had nothing in the way of the cosmetics.
I see.
They were just going to go with the Mustang GT stripe, and mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then they were going to add a bunch of chrome on the side.
Oh, yeah.
So I immediately threw all the chrome, took all the chrome stuff off. They had these C-pillar emblems. I removed those, and they had this fake scoop in the rear fender. Well, mm-hmm. I got that removed. All the inappropriate things I had that I could get off the car, I had removed.
Mm-hmm.
Big rocker moldings.
Yeah.
And I think when we counted them all up, it was quite a few dollars, including in the interior. We had some things removed. And of course, Don Peterson was in product planning. And,
right. Fairly astute.
Yeah, he really got a big character. He got a big kick out. He says,
"Oh, did he?"
He says, "Jesus Christ, you trying to do our job for us?" I says, "No." I said, "Just trying to do the job, period." He said, "Well, and he was pleased.
Uh-huh.
He's saying, "You're the first guy that's come along here and taken stuff off the car rather than put stuff on." But, that was a case in point. We.
Yeah.